KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. Coming up, comprehensive coverage of this week's insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, including an in-depth interview with New Mexico U.S. Senator Ben Ray Lujan. But first, a Texas congresswoman was among the lawmakers inside the U.S. Capitol when rioters overran the building. El Paso Representative Veronica Escobar recounts the moment when law enforcement tried to keep the violent pro-Trump mob from breaking into the House chamber. KTEP's Angela Cocherga reports.
El Paso's Congresswoman Veronica Escobar was among those trapped inside the House chamber as a mob of pro-Trump extremists stormed the Capitol building in Washington. She said Capitol Police told members of Congress to crouch down as armed rioters tried to break in.
From my vantage point, I could see very clearly Capitol Police had their guns out, were pointed out the door, and were yelling at them to get away from the door, to put their weapons down. And I could just hear them pounding. And then I heard shots.
Congresswoman Escobar calls the pro-Trump extremists terrorists and says the president is to blame for inciting violence.
He needs to be removed from office as quickly as possible. He is a threat and a danger, not just to our democracy and our republic, but to public safety.
She supports calls to remove the president by impeachment or Article 25, invoked when a president is unable to carry out the duties of his office. I'm Angela Cocherga in El Paso.
Texas Congressman Joaquin Castro was also among the lawmakers at the Capitol during Wednesday's attack. The San Antonio Democrat told the Texas Tribune that President Donald Trump was among those who inspired the insurrection.
I'm glad that most elected officials, regardless of their party, now are calling for calm and for peace. But you also have to consider the actions and the words that led up to today. And it was Donald Trump foremost, but it was also people like Ted Cruz who enabled us to get to where we are today.
Senator Ted Cruz of Texas has led a group of Republicans challenging President-elect Joe Biden's victory. Castro is calling on Cruz to resign. Cruz on Twitter said violence is unacceptable and those engaged in violence should be prosecuted. Well, some say Texas had a pivotal role in Wednesday's insurrection, with elected officials offering support to those refusing to accept the election results. KERA's Brett Jaspers reports.
Texas's part in the historic day started with Ken Paxton, the state's attorney general. He spoke at a pro-Trump rally in D.C. and was cheered for his effort last month to overturn presidential election results in other states.
And because we're here today, the message goes on, we will not quit fighting.
Then, during Congress's ceremonial electoral vote counting, Texas Senator Ted Cruz fed the false narrative that there's a factual dispute over who won the election. He objected to counting votes for President-elect Joe Biden.
And let me be clear, this objection is for the state of Arizona, but it is broader than that.
Cruz is widely thought to be running again for president in 2024 and trying to appeal to supporters of President Trump. After pro-Trump extremists stormed the Capitol, Cruz tweeted that violence is always unacceptable, yet he continued to fight critics who accused him of stoking the mob. Liberal groups called on both Paxton and Cruz to resign for fueling the violence. Republican Representative Ron Wright of Arlington had also planned to object to the electoral vote ceremony. Later Wednesday afternoon, he condemned the day's violence in, quote, the strongest terms possible. Mark Vesey is a Democrat who represents parts of North Texas. He said the lawmakers who went along with President Trump did it to curry favor with his voters.
So I would say to Cruz and to anyone that when you see something that is wrong and goes against what our country is all about, and something and you see someone going against what our Constitution is all about, say no.
Another Texan, former President George W. Bush, said he was, quote, appalled by the reckless behavior of some political leaders since the election. I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
Joining me now to discuss this week's events, New Mexico U.S. Senator Ben Ray Lujan. Senator, let's start with your reaction to the attack on the Capitol. I'm sure that you didn't think that this is how your time in the Senate would begin.
Well, Fred, yesterday was a very dark day in our nation's history, and to see people come together, you know, these thugs and this very violent attack on our republic, on our nation's capital, stormed the United States Capitol. There's been so much reflection that this has only happened twice in our nation's history. You have to go back to the War of 1812, and now January 6th of 2020, where people went in, people were killed, people lost their lives, and this all happened after President Trump called on his supporters to be in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, which was of 2020, which was the day that the electoral votes would be counted in the U.S. Senate and in the U.S. House. And at 11 a.m. on Wednesday morning, which was yesterday, the president held a large rally at the ellipse of the White House and then called on that group to march to the U.S. Capitol and to say that Republicans that did not support him, that they were weak and that people should be held accountable. And after this attack on the U.S. Capitol began and the storming took place and the Capitol was overtaken after windows being shattered and offices being destroyed and people losing their lives, President Trump still would not call for those people to back down. As a matter of fact, it took some time. And only after Leader Schumer, Speaker Pelosi, President-elect Biden, even Vice President Pence, Mitch McConnell, and others condemned what was happening, it seemed like hours later that President Trump finally said to that crowd to go home. And even then, those words seemed to ring hollow. This is just not right. And I was already disappointed in this president, but now we're seeing a call from Democratic members, from Republicans across America, for the president to step down, for the 25th Amendment to be invoked. We're now seeing cabinet members that were appointed by President Trump resigning, leaving, walking away because of their disgust and disdain for what we saw yesterday. It was a very bad day.
Do you believe, Senator, that he should be removed from office?
I'm very concerned with what we saw over the last few days that culminated in these attacks and these this insurgence into the U.S. Capitol, and the president is responsible for this. And I think the 25th Amendment is appropriate, and those cabinet officials that it's being reported already getting together to talk about this. Many people, including myself, are very concerned with what the president can do over the last 2 weeks of his presidency because of what we witnessed yesterday. It's not a matter of what could happen. We saw what happened yesterday with this president still in the White House.
Well, if that does not happen, if the 25th Amendment is not invoked, should impeachment proceedings begin?
Well, as you know, Fred, I voted to impeach the President of the United States a year ago. I don't know if there is enough time for that to occur between now and the end of his presidency, but if that came forward, I would support that as well.
Okay. Anything else that you would like to say about this incident and things that you think need to be done to prevent something like this from happening again?
Well, Fred, we need a commander-in-chief of the United States, the president of the United States, not to call and incite violence in our country. Congressman Louis Gohmert, you may remember, he's a congressman from Texas. Last week, he said that there should be violence in the streets of America over President Trump's loss of this election. In the end, elected leaders need to tell the American people the truth about the outcome of these elections. President-elect Biden won this election with 306 electoral votes. a record number of people voted for President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris. Just as we heard from our Democratic senators yesterday, like Cory Booker and Leader Schumer and Dick Durbin, we also heard from Mitt Romney and Lindsey Graham, who called on these Republican leaders that are supporting this effort of President Trump to tell the American people the truth of the outcome of this election, as opposed to spreading those conspiracy theories. So that needs to happen. And then just lastly, Fred, you know, just to share with you and to all the listeners, yesterday when we were in the United States Senate in session, hearing debate from U.S. senators, you could hear the growing noise coming from the front of the United States Capitol. And just as you, the noise got louder and louder, you saw Secret Service descend into the United States Chamber. They were able to get the vice president. They escorted the vice president out of the chamber. Then Capitol Police and other Secret Service came into the Senate floor, and there was a lot of noise and yelling, and they were saying, lock the doors, the Capitol has been breached. And so as they locked all the doors in the Senate chamber, there was a lot of unease and uncertainty, and you could hear the loud noise. And then somebody in the chamber said, there have been shots fired in the Capitol. And then moments later, there was a lot of noise, and then they said, get them out of here. And then they opened up one of those doors, and they moved everyone in the Senate chamber to a secure location. And then to see the Capitol just destroyed, a symbol of our democracy, of our republic, from our founders and our Constitution, Fred, destroyed the way that it was. Again, two times in our nation's history, back in 1812 and now January 6th of 2020. This is a bad day. And I'm hopeful that everyone that is responsible for this be held accountable.
Well, we're very glad that you are safe and that you were able to take a few minutes with us today to talk about this. And we look forward to talking with you again soon on hopefully other circumstances and legislation that you want to pursue in the Senate.
I look forward to that, Fred, and, you know, just want to thank all of the people of New Mexico who reached out via social media with phone calls and text messages and email for their prayers and for their concern. And, you know, especially now with families facing all the challenges with COVID-19, I'm encouraged that now that these two Senate seats were won in Georgia, that we'll have a Democratic majority in the Senate, that we'll have a Democratic majority in the House, and we can work with President-elect Biden and Harris and finally deliver that relief that the American people and our fellow New Mexicans deserve to help them rebuild and recover, sir. So I look forward to talking to you more in the future, Fred.
Senator Ben Ray Lujan, Senator, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
Well, as we've been telling you, the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol Wednesday sent members of Congress, their staff, journalists, and other workers rushing into locked offices. North Texas Democratic Congressman Mark Vesey, however, was not in the building. He was outside walking over to the Capitol. KERA's Brett Jasper spoke to Vesey after the congressman got a text from Capitol Police that one of the office buildings there had been compromised and was being shut down.
I thought to myself, that's interesting. And so I slowed down a little bit and then got another text saying that everybody should go into their offices, lock the doors, and turn off all the lights and not make any noise. And so I just turned around.
I guess the broader picture is that this was stoked by the events of the last 2 months by the president. But I wonder what your message is for Republicans in Congress, especially those like Senator Cruz, right, who objected to the vote counting and contributed to the false narrative that the election was in dispute. What do you say now to those fellow lawmakers?
I really do think that by them playing into these crazy conspiracies and you know,
saying that these cities like Milwaukee and Chicago and Philadelphia, where you have large black populations, that there was voter fraud that was taking place, that they played into this conspiratorial field dynamics that was laced with racial undertones, and that they made this situation worse. And we need for people on both sides of the aisle, when they see things like this, to not see an opportunity to further their own political ambitions, but to stand up and do the right thing, even if it means you don't come back here.
Would you vote for new articles of impeachment for President Trump?
Right now, I'm just focused on, I don't have a comment on it one way or the other. I'm just, right now, I'm focused on us showing this crowd that we are not going to lie down and let you control when we exercise our peaceful exchange of power in this country. I'm just not. And then, you know, tomorrow I'll, you know, once we have a chance to go through all of this, I'll have some more chances to think about exactly the question that you posed.
One last question. I wonder if you're making comparisons in your mind, as I think a lot of people are, that if this were a group of African-American people storming the Capitol, that they would have been treated differently by law enforcement and the whole situation might have ended sooner or differently. What do you think?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Not only that, I mean, I think that it needs to, I really think it needs to open up an entire dialogue about policing in this country. I mean, they would, if it had been a large group of African Americans that were coming to the Capitol, they probably would have immediately been in riot gear. You know, right now, instead, what you saw, if you go back and see the video and you see the Capitol policeman opening up the gate for some of the rioters to like come through, is that they really didn't feel that threatened. And so, like, what is it? Like, what? You know, is what is, like, you know, hardwired inside of people to see, you know, black people, particularly black men, as dangerous, you know, criminals, and you see other people as exercising their First Amendment rights.
Congressman Mark Vesey, thank you so much for making a little bit of time.
Yeah, no, thank you, Brett. I appreciate it.
To state politics now, and the New Mexico legislative session starting this month, important to all of us, and a new report is recommending changes to tax policy in the land of enchantment. More from the New Mexico News Connections, Roz Brown.
New Mexico could use the inequities revealed by the coronavirus pandemic to overhaul tax policy and create a more fair-minded future for its residents, according to a new report. Paige Knight with New Mexico Voices for Children says people may not associate systemic racism with tax policies, but they often benefit some groups while disadvantaging others. She notes that the state's highest income earners and large corporations receive tax cuts based on the trickle-down economic school of thought that never resulted in promised jobs or other benefits for the majority of residents.
Ultimately, these rather ineffective and unnecessary tax cuts to the wealthy and well-connected in New Mexico, they've really starved our schools and our healthcare system of important funding.
The New Mexico Voices for Children 2020 report recommends lawmakers create an equitable budget and tax code to ensure the wealthy pay their fair share in taxes. It also encourages the state to enact targeted policies and tax cuts for families struggling financially. Knight notes that schools, hospitals, and infrastructure benefit all New Mexicans, but not everyone is asked to share equal responsibility to support such facilities and improvements.
New Mexicans who earn low and moderate incomes, who are primarily families of color, they pay a much greater share of their income in state and local taxes than do the state's highest income earners, who are disproportionately white.
Knight says legislation passed in 2019 raised the tax rate for those in the top 3% of earners and improved the overall equity of the tax code, but more remains to be done. She says if targeted tax credits and rebates were provided for families struggling financially, families could more quickly achieve financial security. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
Renters under financial strain from the pandemic will see more relief soon. State and local agencies are expected to get $1.9 billion in federal rental assistance this month. KERA's Christopher Connolly reports the funds come as households continue to fall behind on rent.
The money's coming from the massive coronavirus relief and stimulus bill passed by Congress last month. The $900 billion aid package also extended a nationwide eviction moratorium issued by the CDC. It was slated to end with the end of 2020, but now it'll expire at the end of January. Sandy Rollins heads up the Texas Tenants Union.
This is breathing a little bit easier because the CDC eviction moratorium has been extended. But the pandemic's not going to be over on February 1st. People aren't going to be back to full employment on February 1st.
Rollins says the federal rental assistance will help, but she thinks more will be needed. It's also not clear whether local governments and nonprofits will have enough time to get the money into the hands of landlords before eviction protections end for struggling renters. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
Well, the Centers for Disease Control says that parks and trails can promote physical activity and community engagement and provide both environmental and mental health benefits. When well designed, parks have been shown to reduce stress and foster community interaction, according to the CDC. This week, the Las Cruces City Council passed a unanimous resolution to build a new park on the East Mesa in the Mesa Grande neighborhood. They want to do that by next January. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
Councilor Gil Sork has spent the last 8 years advocating for a park to be built in the Mesa Grande Road neighborhood of Las Cruces. Over the last 2 decades, multiple housing developments have been constructed in the area, and Zork reports that building a park is on the minds of his constituents.
This area of the East Mesa hasn't had a park ever for children. Very far away, there's two parks, not at a distance that children up to 10 years old could ever go and walk to. This is a park that's been asked for 8 years, and I've been asking staff to try to find a park, and then I noticed this last time we went through the CIP, money was taken away from what was supposed to be used for this park. And so this is why I want to get it in a resolution so that it will be done.
Zork, who pushed for a 1-year timeline for the project, brought up cost-saving measures, including using existing city-owned land for the construction site or trading a piece of property with the county. A total cost estimate will be dependent on the price of land. But construction costs for a standard 2-acre park were estimated to be $500,000. Building a park smaller than the standard 2 acres was also discussed, with Councillor Tessa Abeda-Stuvi speaking about how even small parks can make a big difference in a community.
I do recognize that in the district that you serve, this community does need access to a park and be able to utilize, you know, all that the city can have to offer. From a perspective that I'm coming from with different families, utilizing parks, being around other families with parks, you know, more of the pocket-sized parks or neighborhood parks are so accessible to people and are utilized really heavily in different areas.
Councillor Ioana Bencomo also indicated her support of the project, advocating for as large a park as possible.
I really feel like the folks in this particular neighborhood deserve a good park, and they've been clearly asking for one for a really long time. So I would urge us to really think about not having the mindset of, well, they'll be grateful for whatever size park, because I think that feels really unfair to me. If we really should strive for getting these folks a park that fits their needs and that any other community throughout District 5 or 6 would, you know, would get. So I think that we should really try to push for a larger park, if at all possible.
The council voted to explore funding the project out of the Philippou Fund, a fund that includes money from a settlement between a local developer and the city, currently totaling approximately $900,000. With the passing of the resolution, the city will now explore potential building sites, which will determine the size of the park. Zork outlined the next steps of the project for the city.
Just doing a cursory look at the map, I counted 5 or 6 parcels of land that could have a park on it. They were parts of developments and parts of that are not developments yet. I was thinking that, you know, if the staff could go out and explore those 5, 6, 7, or 8 even possibilities in that area and come back with the 2 best ones that we could choose from, That would probably be the best way to do it.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
Earlier, we told you about the health and environmental benefits of parks. What about the economic benefits? There are some key findings from research conducted by the Center for Regional Analysis at George Mason University for the Economic Impact of Local Parks report. It found $166 billion in economic activity and more than 1.1 million jobs supported by local park and recreation agencies in 2017. Beyond the nationwide impact, the report shows the economic contribution of parks and recreation at the state level, too. The estimates of total economic impacts include direct, indirect, and induced effects of operations and capital spending by local park and recreation agencies in each state. Important as we consider the new park in Las Cruces and plans for parks across the region. Well, of course, building more natural areas, also a focus of efforts across the country to reduce the effect of climate change. New Mexico and the entire Southwest grappling with the profound impacts brought by climate change, and those will only get worse. So how are we preparing? Journalist Laura Paskus has covered New Mexico's environment for years, and in her new book from the University of New Mexico Press, At the Precipice, New Mexico's Changing Climate, she explores the realities of climate change and the havoc it's been wreaking for years in the state. That includes dying forests, superfires, shrinking water supplies, and of course, average temperatures that are increasing at double the global average. How will New Mexico meet these challenges, and how could we position ourselves to be at the forefront of innovation in dealing with climate change? Laura Paskus talked with KUNM's Megan Kamrick.
You know, scientists have pointed to what could happen as it continued to warm. And here in New Mexico, we see those forecasts just playing out right before our very eyes. We also have populations and issues in the state that already face so many challenges, whether that's poverty or access to fair and equitable education and healthcare and all of those sorts of things. And really, climate change exacerbates so many of those problems in sort of increasing disparities between populations, but also climate change compounds so many of the problems that we are already grappling with as a state.
What are the biggest impacts we're seeing now that will continue to get worse?
I think the biggest impact is truly our water resources. We live in an arid region. We're accustomed to dealing with drought and poor conditions. But in the past, we've always had groundwater to rely upon. People like to look back to the 1950s and the drought that New Mexicans experienced back then. We got through that drought by pumping groundwater. When that drought ended, instead of being like, okay, let's leave that water as sort of a savings account, we just continued to pump and develop and do more and more. So, you know, we're kind of facing these increasingly warm and dry conditions, and we don't have that savings account in many places of groundwater to rely upon. So I really think water is sort of the biggest issue that we really need to confront head on.
How will this all change New Mexico culturally, economically, from a health perspective?
If we don't address climate change, if we don't take it seriously in terms of both cutting greenhouse gas emissions to slow continued warming and to address adaptation, you know, we really could see New Mexico continue to have a hard time facing many of our challenges, where you see power and wealth consolidated in the hands of fewer and fewer people, where you have fewer and fewer people making decisions that benefit the state as a whole. So there's kind of like that side of things that is a very real future. But I love New Mexico and I love New Mexico's communities. And I think that we have a really strong track record of resilience and creativity when it comes to survival in the desert. And so New Mexicans do have great care for the environment, thought for the future, and really, really care about the survival of one another. So I think one very possible future for New Mexico is that we do creatively address these solutions that also rely on knowledge and expertise that so many of our tribal and Hispanic and Spanish communities have already.
We could be leading the world right now in figuring out these things, right?
Yeah. So Dr. Jonathan Overpeck, who is like a person I talk to frequently for the book, something he has talked about is how the Southwestern United States could be leading the way on water scarcity, on energy, on all of these issues, and helping set the standard, helping drive innovation, really leading the way. And so far we're not, but I think that we still can.
You have a sort of mantra in the book. I'm going to quote, "Cultural expectations are abandoned with difficulty. People try to persist until too late. Social conflict and breakdown make the economy worse. And migration is the ultimate solution to climate change." How do you think about this in the context of New Mexico?
Yeah. So, you know, I was at this talk that Dr. Eric Blindman was giving as an archaeologist, which is, you know, what my first career was in that field. And as he was talking about, you know, kind of how prehistorically people adapted or didn't adapt to climate change, he's talking about this. I'm like, holy smokes, he's talking about us right now. And really looking at those four points of his, it's hard to talk about adaptation. It's hard to talk about where we should and shouldn't live. And it's really hard to talk about that when those decisions are being made beyond the community level. As a society, as a culture of New Mexicans, we need to really think about what we need to change in order to have a sustainable future. And one of the conversations where that really needs to happen is in the agricultural community. We all kind of associate New Mexico's agricultural community with, you know, green chili or small farms. That's not necessarily where the change needs to happen. I mean, obviously, what you do on your individual farm does matter, but it's really in the ways in which water is distributed and allocated in these big irrigation districts, like the Middle Rio Grande Conservancy District or the Elephant Butte Irrigation District. We need to be looking at really systemic change in how agriculture works in New Mexico.
That could be a third rail for anyone in politics.
It really could be. And I feel like sometimes what happens when we talk about the need for this really big change in how systems are operated, it's really easy for some people to hijack that conversation and say, you're anti-farmer or you're anti-farming and you're attacking small farmers. And that's not what I've heard anybody do. Thinking about how we more efficiently but equitably use water in our agricultural system is a big conversation that is not an attack on small farmers. And so I hope that we can move away kind of from these old arguments and narratives.
We think about climate issues being these great divisive issues, but they actually could be ways to bring people together on shared interests.
Yeah. I mean, water is such not a political issue or a partisan issue. And climate change, oh my gosh, the survival of the species on this planet is not a partisan issue. And the more like people can have honest personal conversations with one another about this stuff, I think the more we realize, oh yeah, no, this isn't a partisan issue at all.
This is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm talking with journalist Laura Paskus about her new book, At the Precipice, New Mexico's Changing Climate, from University of New Mexico Press. You reminded me, reading your book, what a crazy year 2011 was. First, we had that intense freeze that resulted in rolling blackouts in northern New Mexico. People lost heat. Then we had the gigantic Las Conchas fire in the Jemez Mountains, and I remember seeing that gigantic cloud you thought was the monsoon season. I was coming back from camping and I hit Abiquiu and I was like, what the hell is that? Because it had appeared in like a day and it looked like a mushroom cloud. How did this year presage our future?
Yeah, you are so right. That was such a wild year. And it really, if anything, 2011 should have taught us that in a climate changed world, there is no clear pattern. There's no sense of reliability. In a climate changed world, we're going to see these rapid and unpredictable changes. Sometimes people like to throw out there like, oh, climate change, it'll just be warmer. It'll be a longer growing season. No, it's just a more unpredictable growing season because everything might start growing and blossoming in late February or March, and then you're going to have a freeze in April and lose your entire crop, or there's not enough water to get you through your entire irrigation season. So 2011 really should have been a wake-up call like, hey, nothing's predictable anymore.
It was my first experience with a massive wildfire, seeing that, and I've never quite gotten over that. It felt like the world was coming to an end. I know that sounds dramatic, but it felt like that.
It doesn't. Those are the feelings that we have when we see stuff like that. So many firefighters and fire experts I've talked to over the years, Las Conchas really was, even for people who weren't on that fire or even in New Mexico at that time, Las Conchas was really like a new type of fire that people really started studying what happened with Las Conchas because something like that had never been seen before. Even throughout the West. And that's why this summer was such like a scary summer, I felt, for people in Colorado, because they were seeing those types of fires this summer, which, you know, we really hadn't seen since 2011 here.
You go extensively in your book into the die-offs of trees and forest, and you talked to Dave Gutzler, who's been on this program, and he talked about Albuquerque looking more like El Paso in decades to come. How is climate change accelerating that process?
Yeah. You know, so there's this idea that scientists have been forecasting these impacts. You know, they've known for a long time, if you add this much warming, you're going to tip this system. But everything has been happening so much faster. Our release of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere is happening faster. The warming has happened faster, and all these impacts have happened faster. So just looking like to the Sandias is a great example of that, where you can see there are tens of thousands of acres where we have conifer die-offs. You know, we kind of like, we know intellectually, oh, it's getting warmer. That means it's getting drier. But when you see like tens of thousands of acres of trees dying, and when you see the long-term impacts of that on the landscape and the changes on the landscape and how that affects the watershed and how that affects, you know, heat islands and everything like that, I think Dr. Gutzler's example is a really great reminder, like a visceral reminder of, yeah, Albuquerque is going to be the kind of city that is 200 miles south of here. I mean, that's like a pretty drastic change.
Yeah, I mean, it means people live in El Paso, as he told me, but there ain't many trees there.
Yeah. And what will it be like for people in El Paso and southern New Mexico in 20 years? It's going to be really hot, like unsafe levels of hot for many people.
I didn't realize that till I read your book. Of course, we all know how the world is warming, but it's warming even faster here.
And I'm glad that you had Dr. Gutzler on, because he is awesome and so good at communicating the science. He's the one who explained to me why that is. You know, we don't have the balancing impacts of the oceans. So we're like in the, you know, the land is going to be heating faster than the oceans. So that's why we're warming faster.
Of course, you talk about oil and gas development and the push to extract more oil and gas through fracking, which has resulted in drastic changes to landscapes and indigenous cultures in northwest New Mexico. And we hear about efforts to protect the ancient dwellings at Chaco National Historical Park. But the descendants of those people who are at Chaco are struggling with those impacts. What does that look like?
Yeah, oil and gas development in that region has industrialized parts of that landscape. That ranges from things like the oil and gas wells themselves or the drilling rigs themselves and the flares that you see, especially at night, but which are also very loud and very hot, but also the air quality and the pollution, the traffic. One of the biggest complaints I heard when I was working on that part of the story from people living in the Navajo communities around there was that those big trucks really rip up the roads. And so people live very remotely off the highway and rely on those roads to be able to get to food, to work, to school. And if those roads are inaccessible, they're basically trapped out there, which is a really scary thing to think about. You know, it's a beautiful place. It's a beautiful landscape. These are vibrant communities, but there is an unnecessary level of industrialization and an unfair level of industrialization in northwestern New Mexico, not to mention southeastern New Mexico down in the Permian Basin. The development is just wild down there.
You often refer to New Mexico in the book as a sacrifice zone. What does that mean?
There was an actual federal government report, I think it was from the 1970s, that basically identified New Mexico as a sacrifice zone, that, you know, New Mexico was poor, lacked economic development. And so, you know, basically was seen as an acceptable place to really push things like whether it's oil and gas development or uranium mining. You know, was really seen as a part of the country where people's lives and landscapes could be sacrificed for the benefit of the larger economy. And boy, if that's not a shameful way to look at a place.
You also wrote in your first line, actually, that climate change will deliver a blow to American prosperity. And that was struck me immediately because political arguments against acting on climate change usually have to do with prosperity. And our state budget is highly dependent on oil and gas to fund schools and other services. So how do we start envisioning a future without that?
Yeah, New Mexico really needs to make the decision to extricate ourselves from dependence on oil and gas. And I recognize how hard that is. And it's not an easy thing. And it's not something that can happen overnight. But the global pandemic this year has taught us so many lessons. And one of the lessons really has been that the oil and gas industry is unstable and uncertain. And global forecasters, global analysts looking out 10, 20, 30 years are not seeing a big recovery. You know, New Mexico's used to the boom and bust, and there'll be blips, but we're never going to see these big booms. That's just not where the industry is heading. The industry has continued to cut jobs. Even when production was growing, industry was still cutting jobs because of automation and other factors. And so I feel like COVID really, at the same time that it put pressure on the budget for various reasons, also was kind of like this eye-opening experience and almost like an impetus to be like, oh, we see that this isn't a good idea. We see that it's dropping off. Let's get moving right now instead of waiting 5 or 10 years when things will be even worse for oil and gas and certainly far worse in terms of warming and out of control emissions.
Laura Paskus talking with KUNM's Megan Kamrick. Her book is At the Precipice, New Mexico's Changing Climates. To commentary now, and should a lame duck president be able to carry out executions? Some thoughts from commentator Walt Rubel.
COVID-19 has temporarily spared the life of Lisa Montgomery, but the Trump administration is working furiously to see that she dies before he leaves office. In July, the Trump administration announced that the federal government would resume executions after a 16-year pause. The Obama administration had ordered a halt and review in 2014 after the horrific botched execution of Clayton Lockett in Oklahoma. The federal review is done, and the nation is ready to get back to the business of putting people to death, Trump Attorney General William Barr announced last summer. Daniel Lewis Lee was the first to be executed on July 14th. Once the federal death chamber was up and running, they started making up for lost time. Wesley Ira Perkey was executed on July 16th, followed by Dustin Lee Honkin one day later. Lesmond Charles Mitchell and Keith Dwayne Nelson were both put to death in August. William Emmett LaCroix Jr. and Christopher Andre Valva followed in September. Losing the election has only made Trump more determined to finish the job. Orlando Cordia Hall was put to death on November 19th, followed by Brandon Bernard on December 10th and Alfred Bourgeois on December 11th. Three more executions are scheduled before Trump leaves office, including Montgomery's. She was originally scheduled to be put to death last month, but the execution was postponed after her attorney caught COVID-19 while visiting her in prison. The U.S. Court of Appeals has now cleared the way for her execution on January 12th, when she'll be the first woman put to death by the federal government in nearly 70 years. By the time he's done, Trump will have presided over more civilian executions during the transition period than any president in our nation's history. Much of the damage being done in the final days of this administration can and will be undone by new President Joe Biden. But not this. It's understandable that news of these executions has been buried beneath the swirl of daily outrages, but we need to understand what's happening and decide if we agree with it. We've had this uneasy ceasefire in recent years based on the idea that we can't execute people because we couldn't find the right toxic mix of chemicals. That was always a lame excuse to put off addressing the issue. Do we want to give our government the power to kill its residents? If the answer is yes, then Trump should be commended. But if the answer is no, we should change our laws. Clearly, relying on the judgment and compassion of wise and benevolent leaders is a hit-or-miss proposition. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent the views of KRWG or NMSU. In March, the StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative visited Las Cruces. Every Monday, we're presenting portions of the interviews conducted during the visit. Today, David Turner, an Army veteran, is interviewed by StoryCorps' Luigi Villanueva.
I was part of a program. I don't know if they still do it. It's called Delayed Enlistment. My junior year in high school, I enlisted in the service. I wasn't active duty, but my whole year in high school, my senior year, I was in the service.
Okay. So you must have been about 17 years old at this time.
Yeah.
Do you remember what motivated you to sign up?
I knew I didn't want to do college. This is 1977, so we're only 2 years removed from Vietnam. So the military was on a downslope, you know, a lot of issues. The public wasn't up there. I just wanted to get out of town. I think the biggest thing is I wanted to leave.
So how did your parents feel when you
told them? They had to sign me up for it. And just before I went in, I got cold feet, wanted to get out of it. But my parents, I give them credit. They said, nope, you signed up for it. You do it. It was a contract. They were real big about that. You know, your word is your word. My first duty station was Korea, South Korea. And it was really tough time because while I'm at dog school, the South Korean president had been assassinated, Park Chung-hee. This is 79. So when we got there, they didn't have it. They implemented a midnight to 4 a.m. curfew, and they meant it. They shoot you, then pick you up and ask you questions. The Koreans, South Koreans, because they were in turmoil. Then I was stationed at 1st to the 2nd Air Defense Artillery Delta Battery, and it was a hot missile site. And I'm a dog handler. And dog handlers and military police, we got special duty. I didn't have to do KP because I'm out walking a fence line, basically like you might imagine, with a dog. And the dogs we had at that time were sentry dogs. And I was the last sentry dog class. And those dogs were basically like the Vietnam dogs. That dog bit you, and you had to choke the dog to get it off. There was no command to get it off. A patrol dog, you got to stop the action of the dog. You can say, out, and the dog will stop. Just come to a dead stop and watch you until you do something wrong. And if the dog bites you, you can tell it, out, and it'll stop biting you. But my dog wasn't built that way. He was built to tear you apart because I'm guarding a hot missile site. Propaganda balloons would come over. They have an altitude button in them and a battery, and it's full of propaganda from North Korea. And then it would explode, and all the propaganda would rain down on the
like just hill. Papers and yeah, stuff papers. Like that?
And then we'd find the balloon and stuff on our sites, and it'd have Duracell battery, Ever Ready batteries that had been black marketed up to North Korea, and you could see the technology and stuff in it, the wires.
Do you remember what any of the papers or anything
said? A lot of times it was basically to get South Koreans to come and join the North, you know. And then I went to Fort Polk, Louisiana, and I was planning on getting out, but they gave me Hawaii as my dream sheet for my reenlistment. So I said, okay, I'll reenlist. Send me to Hawaii. And then I had my PTSD for me. It's not combat because I didn't do any combat. It's more first responders type. Because when you're on a base in the States and stuff, I didn't have to guard missile sites. So I actually did police work on a base at Schofield Barracks. Traffic, DWI, speeding, homicide investigation,
so
suicide.
So this is all people
just like a policeman does.
In the Army, though, right?
Military. Because okay. You got to realize any military installation is just like a little city. And my PTSD and stuff came from the first time that I found out what a pedophile was. A little girl was abducted at a bowling alley in Schofield Barracks. And we had to go search, and being a dog handler, they used the dogs to search. And fortunately or unfortunately, I was the one that found her body in a dumpster. And that's my type of PTSD that I have, not combat, but first responder type PTSD.
When did it occur to you that you started wanting to look for some help or find a way to cope?
My drug of choice for me to combat my PTSD was money and stuff. And that was my biggest stressor. So got a bunch of credit card debts and stuff like that. And it just imploded on me. So you had to do a bankruptcy and stuff like that. And then getting hurt really bad at the police department didn't help me either. So when I moved over here, that's when I got involved into the VA in El Paso, got signed up. They have the outpatient clinic here. But the biggest thing is they were pumping me full of pills. What really helped me was coming and doing cognitive therapy. So I got my marijuana card, and it's completely changed. I have no medicines. I've dropped 150 pounds.
What do you think is the best thing that, you know, civilians and the government can do for veterans these days?
It's just my opinion, but if you serve and your honorable discharge is like all the guidelines, and if you serve more than 3 years, maybe two tours and stuff, or two terms, enlistments, 8 years or whatever, I think they should have some type of a retirement. If your congressman and stuff can do two tours or two sittings up there and get full retirement, why can't a soldier get that? You know, you shouldn't have to wait until you do 20 years and you're all busted up to get any type of compensation. They should be compensated much better, especially with mental health and stuff and their physical health.
Army veteran David Turner. To hear this segment and the full interview with Turner, you can go to the StoryCorps page in the radio section at krwg.org. Funding for this segment provided by the Heritage Assisted Living, taking COVID-19 precautions and offering specialized care for their residents, accepting admission in their 3 sanitized homes. More information at 575-525-9215 or heritage-lc.com. That's KRWG News This Week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for being with us. If you ever miss the show on Saturday night, no worries. We have you covered. KRWG News This Week is always available in the local radio section at krwg.org. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, this is KRWG Las Cruces and KRXG Silver City. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.